both of you in the room. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share our research activity from the Center for Distance Education. Yes, my name is Marty Cleveland Dennis. I'm an associate professor at Athabasca University and the program director of the Master of Distance Education. So this Lunch and Learn session is designed to give you an overview of the kind of work that goes on out of the Center for Distance Education. We appreciate very much the opportunity to do this. We're very tied in our center to the mission of Athabasca University and committed to doing research that is dedicated to the removal of barriers that restrict access to and success in university level study, and to increasing equality of educational opportunity for adult learners worldwide. We hope that through these presentations, we will spark some interest across the campus, and we certainly invite you to contact us if you see things that we're working on that interest us. And for my part, and I'll speak for myself here, if you're interested in doing research or want to join a research team, I would love to talk to you. Today, in presentation order, we have Gail tells me about 90 minutes to do our presentation, and there are five of us who are going to tell you about our research, and then we'll leave time for comments and questions. So I'm going to start us off, and then you'll hear from Dr. Tom Jones, Dr. Deborah Hoven, Dr. Pat Fay, and Dr. Muhammad Ali. What we want to do is outline our research programs to you, and we are quite anxious to hear your comments and any questions that you have. Let me start my part of the presentation by just telling you a little bit about myself. I'm imagining that no one has time to go to colleagues' bios and read through backgrounds and things. So I wanted to say in particular that I'm a sociologist. My training is in sociology, and that I have a great passion for teaching and for research, and I, in fact, started teaching when I was 15, which is now, by rapid calculation, about 70% of my life. At that time, of course, I was involved in community-based education through a sporting activity where I became a coach and an instructor. And my teaching then moved to more adult ed issues, issues of social equity as I got more involved in the study of social factors and equity, and taught for places like the Calgary Birth Control Association and various parenting associations, Calgary Health Board, and so on. So that said, as my passion for research increased, my first love is to do research about teaching. And last year, the slide that's up is the beginning of the blog that I have in MeToU. If any of you are interested in reading about what I did on my sabbatical, you can go to MeToU and find me and read the description of what I did at that time. On my sabbatical, what I wanted to do was create endings of some and beginnings of other research plans and projects. One of the dangers of being a researcher in this field, in something that's so innovative and dynamic, is getting involved in too many projects. So my sabbatical was to try and get control over some of that. If you want to know how well I did, let's talk about that privately. The Community of Inquiry framework was designed Well, in the late 90s and in the early 2000s by Randy Garrison, our own Terry Anderson, and Walter Archer, who was at that time, they were all at the University of Alberta. And much of my work in the recent past has been around the validation of this particular framework. And at the moment, I'm on a research team with Randy and, let me see, can I count that quickly, six other researchers in North America who are looking at this particular explication of the life of an online student and the requirements of an online teacher. What we have done most recently is examined the work related to this particular theoretical framework. And our recent empirical research certainly support the community of inquiry as a parsimonious and coherent theory of online learning. If you haven't seen this diagram yet, let me just take a moment to explain it to you. Essentially, the community of inquiry framework consists of three elements: social presence, teaching presence, and cognitive presence, each of which is integral to the instrument. And in the combination of these three elements, the educational experience unfolds. So we created over, I don't know, hundreds of email and a lot of teleconferences, initially a 31-item instrument to measure the components of these elements. Not only the elements individually, but how they interact. We have that validation came across multiple institutions and many students. In fact, Peter Shea's work, because Peter works at the State Universities of New York, and they have, I believe, something like 54 campuses. So when Peter gets involved, we have thousands of students. So it gave us a great opportunity to shape and reshape, and we now have an instrument that we feel has the kind of validity and reliability that tells us when a community of inquiry is, in fact, at work. Here are references to the articles where we published our findings from this instrument validation, and the instrument itself is available in these articles so that if this is something you might want to use or look at, you are certainly welcome to find it there. So, of course, the research process never ends, and each time you do something, you come up with more questions. And one of the things that we now, of course, want to know is what we can measure the community of inquiry effectively now. What affects putting a community of inquiry in place? And so that's going on in multiple places in many different ways. This is something that Randy and I, this is a structural equation model that Randy and I created with a statistician at the University of Calgary to look at the effects of gender and program on the three presences. The findings of this modeling confirmed the theoretical predictions of the framework and provided some more insights for us into the dynamic relationships among the presence. It's clear that all three presences are interconnected and they influence each other in the manner in which we've hypothesized. It also demonstrates for us that at least in this particular sample, and I'm not ready to close the inquiry yet, but in this particular sample, there was no gender effect. And that meant that we can assume that it is important to females as it is to males to be socially present, to be cognitively present, and to have a sense of teaching presence. There was, however, a program effect on cognitive presence. And that is certainly interesting and, I believe, quite explainable. What we find is that the extent to which the subject matter demands that you push yourself to evaluative and higher other kinds of higher order thinking, the students will do it. There's quite likely a teacher effect as well, and that will follow in the work that we're doing, and some other people are working on this as well. In other words, what is it that the teacher is doing through multiple types of subject matter that will push students to high levels of cognitive presence? We assume in higher education that's something that we would all desire, and we want to say that regardless of subject matter, we should have a high level of cognitive presence. And so when we see that there is a program effect, we want to know what that is. And then, of course, the next most obvious question is, how can we make that happen in all programs across all subjects? And here is what we will be moving to next, that not only do we see even more clearly now this dynamic relationship among the three presents, but we want to further study not only the categories, but how this works across subject matter. And one of the people listed in that research team is Ben Arbaugh, and he just recently approached me and said, let's do something really specific across subject matter. We have started doing that, and we'll be going to the American Education Research Association to present our findings on that this spring. One of my graduate students, in fact, said to me one day, I don't think that Garrison, Anderson, and Archer have said enough about emotion in community of inquiry. In the current theoretical model, emotion is described under social presence and is something that's only referred to briefly. This I show you this model because it is one of the common models that tries to unpack the relationship between emotion and learning. And I offer it to you so that if this is something that interests you, you can go a little further, look up what Cort and his colleagues have to say about emotion and learning. But what we did was take the idea of emotional presence in the online community of inquiry, and we added to the original 34 items, six items that we believe would tap more specifically into the actual emotionality of being in an online environment and how that affects learning. And as you can see in this, and again, I'm not going to go through and describe it because I don't have time, but you can certainly come back to this if you're interested, that the emotionality rests within the other presences. It's not a fourth presence, but emotion and learning will have an impact on each of the other three presences. So we added these items to the instrument. We reran the factor analysis. And in fact, with one exception, they do load as we predicted. Expressing emotion in relation to expressing ideas was acceptable in this course. We predicted would load with cognitive presence, but it in fact loads with teaching presence. So what the research did tell us, though, is that there is an emotion effect, and we are very interested in exploring it further. What I wrote recently, this is something I did for the European Distance Education Network, is that instructors can model emotional response, explain its role in the instructor's own learning, teach how to bring emotion to consciousness, and make use of emotional states in a learning situation. So we feel we have enough evidence now to say it is there, it is having an effect. Now we need to get a little deeper into how all of that works. very briefly here, we actually did interviews with Athabasca instructors, some of you may be in the room, and instructors at the Open University of Catalonia. And we went through, this is the results from 40 instructors. And what we did was have the research assistants go through and identify utterances and how they might fit in the community of inquiry. And we did find, in fact, that their discussion of teaching in a community of inquiry involved 172 references to emotion. So again, just more evidence for us that it is there. Now we need to say what we do about it. And this is just my diagram to show that, again, to reemphasize that we don't think emotional presence is a fourth presence. We think it's integral. Next, another big research project for me is unpacking issues of leadership in open and distance higher education. This is our research question: are leadership models at work in open and distance higher education as current and innovative as this model of education? And the work that I spent a month in Europe last year interviewing faculty, staff, senior administration about this particular issue. We were looking in particular for distributed leadership, and this is in fact a theoretical model. There is a separation of leader and follower, leadership from a remote physical location, and using only technological means of communication, etc. And again, working with other people who are studying leadership in this area and looking at the data that we have to date, we still have what I would call preliminary findings. We're finding that leadership in a network of interacting individuals and partnerships is in fact present in many of the institutions that we looked at that are open and distance higher education institutions. That there is a flexibility and a boundary openness. There's a lot of dynamism. Things change often. Policies are continually under renewal and so on. That there's a dispersed complexity and a lot of variability. Concerted collaborative action through relationships, all sort of working from what is loosely referred to as central support. Some say there isn't enough. Some say there's too much. And I will stop there and pass it over to Tom. Tom, are you there?
Somebody could applaud or make a sign or whatever in the participants list. Okay, great. All right, to begin, there's the title of my presentation today, The Impact of Distance Education on a Small Rural Island. What I was interested in doing here was, I guess to use a kind of a colloquial phrase, trying to see what happens when the rubber hits the road, that is, beyond courses and readings and conferences and all the good things that academics do. I wanted to see exactly how distance ed might impact in a particular concrete situation. The small rural island, that's the focus of this needs assessment, is Hornby Island on the west coast of British Columbia. Some of you may have visited that island over the summer months. It's quite popular with tourists. The population during the winter, September through June, is quite small, 800 full-time residents, and it balloons, of course, in the summer to many thousands, especially when the music festival is on in August. Just one small note about the geography. Hornby Island is separated from Vancouver Island by another island, Denman Island, so to access Hornby Island from Vancouver Island, one must take two ferries, first to Denman Island and then a second ferry to Hornby Island. Both the ferry rides are short, 10, 12 minutes or so, but they do involve some planning and cost, etc. There's a quick picture of one of the beaches on Hornby Island. So in essence, what I was doing or interested in doing was getting a snapshot of how distance education might integrate into the community in terms of needs, desires, whatever, upgrading training with respect to four groups of individuals, the younger children, people in the trades, people interested in secondary education, and fourthly, people interested in what we might call lifelong learning. Some of the important characteristics of Hornby Island from this perspective is that there is a community school. It offers classes from kindergarten through to grade 7, the end of elementary school. Children who go to middle school and secondary school must go to this appropriate schools in Courtney and Comox, and I'll get to that issue a little bit more in some detail. There is what is called a room to grow, which is a small building close by the community school. And that room to grow is funded by various monies, federal and provincial. One of the main uses is for people who are interested in pursuing jobs of one kind or another. So there's help with resume writing, finding resources, etc., and staff by somebody who's, again, paid by the federal government for some day or two a week. But it's a good place in that it has a physical presence, of course. There's computer terminals there and coffee and that. There's also a computer access center in that same little building. Some of you may have heard of the North Island Distance Education School, NIDES, which was being accessed or utilized by a number of high school students on the island to take courses of one kind or another, and in some cases is finishing up their high school certificate. As I mentioned earlier, students, middle school and secondary school students will travel to Courtney and Comox. Good time to bring up what these children must cope with. There are probably 15 to 20 affected on who live on Hornby Island, but in essence, the children are required to travel again, take the two ferries and then a bus into the towns or cities of Courtney and Comox, which is about a half an hour away from the last ferry ride. So, in a nutshell, these students must travel 2 hours to school in the morning and 2 hours to return home. So these children are on buses and ferries for 4 hours each day, unsupervised. And as you'll see in a moment, that one of the findings that I came up with was, and also suggestions how to ameliorate this problem, which is quite substantive. In terms of internet access, there's the range of dial-up and ADSL. There is high-speed through TELUS, so many people on the island who have computers do have access to the internet through a high-speed connection. And also, the people, the 800 or so full-time people, quite a diverse group, as you can find in any area, really, but these islands have a preponderance of artistic and innovative people. The polite words are eccentric and divergent thinkers and things like that, but at the very least, they're very interesting, come up with interesting solutions to problems. The foci of this needs assessment was, as mentioned earlier, K-12, post-secondary, and vocational trades upgrading, and also lifelong learning. So I was interested in finding out, again, the impact that distance education might have on these four groups. With my research assistant, we interviewed 48 individuals across those four groups. There's the breakdown in terms of gender. The age and gender distribution, other than the very elderly, there's kind of a relatively equal distribution across age ranges. This slide makes reference to, of those 44 individuals, how many had previous distance education experience. You can see about a fifth of them had, or sixth of them, excuse me, with respect to computers, who owned a computer. Many did, 39 out of the 48. And in terms of internet access, a little less, 31 out of the 48. Now, as to what might distance education do for these residents of this island, the interest in terms of post-secondary was as visible here, evident on this graph. Again, a quite predictable actually distribution across the sciences and the humanities. Some of the students, of the interest would reflect individuals who wanted to do a complete degree via distance education, which is quite possible, or to cap their existing credits to attain a degree. And there were some, I don't have that here, but who would have been interested in graduate school, although that would have been very few of the 48 total subjects. In terms of the vocational interest that might be aided and abetted by distance education, you can see many in the trades, carpentry being particularly desirable. And many of these trades, of course, are associated with construction of one kind or another, because as on many small islands, including the Gulf Islands, including Hornby Island, there is no manufacturing. So many of the vocational needs or training or skills or journeyman certificates would be in the area of home construction and that kind of thing. Lifelong learning, a whole pastiche of interests, herbs, photography, archaeology, you can see the list here. I guess if you surveyed half dozen people in your area, you'd probably find it to be comparable kinds of interests. Many are focused on, of course, the environment or rural or farming interests, hobby interests, beekeeping, pruning, landscaping, as a number of individuals make their living by tending to people's properties, landscaping, taking care of things. Now, the general themes for support as opposed to impact, generally, these 48 participants, the use of software for distance education was of concern to them, both in their competencies with respect to software generally, but also if they were to be involved in a formal program of instruction, or education or training, there would be requirements there in terms of whatever software is being used to deliver the instruction. That was a concern. There was also expressed a desire or need for a coordinator who would operate out of this small room to learn facility next to community school, simply because there would be a myriad of concerns or problems that might arise, issues that have to be resolved, and it couldn't be the service that might be available to them or access couldn't be just open-ended. There would have to be somebody there to provide support, not surprisingly. Also comes up in distance education as an important factor quite often is this idea of independence and the need for communication between and among students and instructors or whatever. So the group on Hornby Island are of the same mind that their peer support. Here they're referring maybe more to making this room to learn facility available at particular times when the students could help each other. And also the issue of disability and old age. There are a number of older individuals on elderly on Hornby Island, and getting around to or making their way to this facility would be problematic. That would have to be dealt with in some fashion, perhaps with volunteer drivers or whatever. Now, the impact if a facility, distance education facility, were available in whatever shape it might take, but attending to the issues that have been raised so far, the impact would be in many ways positive, of course, and also substantive. The first one is, as you can read, is the residents, many could remain on the island. It turns out that a number of families will leave the small rural island and go into the larger towns from Courtenay right down to Victoria to attend to their children's educational needs. And that can be, or can result in a number of people just leaving the island, it just has an impact on all sorts of fronts. The difficulty in attracting young families, young couples going to this island where there are these school issues that I mentioned earlier, and I'll get to in a moment, can be problematic. There's that issue of reducing the travel for high school students, and I'll have a suggestion about how that might have been resolved or might be resolved. Preparation for future studies would be very important for a number of individuals, especially in the trades, who before perhaps going to one of the technical schools in British Columbia or other provinces, BCIT would come to mind in Burnaby, they would like to prepare themselves in terms of enabling competencies, mathematics, for example, for carpenters or those kinds of things, and would prefer or would like to be able to do that before they head off or would have to leave the island for some period of time to take the formal classroom instruction at these vocational institutes. Just generally, the idea of being self-sufficient and motivation, and having a chance, I guess, to motivate themselves to move on. The self-sufficiency is again a characteristic of many of these island dwellers, so they kind of gravitate towards something that has that aura. And also, wages, people being able to stay again on the island, and they can make their living there, and also work opportunities. Here's a few quotes. I won't spend too much time on this. You can just take a glance. These are quotes that are in support of a distance education facility on this island. And you may notice the last one. There's mention made of somebody this is back to the idea of a coordinator, either part-time or full-time, who could help at this room to grow facility, providing support for any of the individuals who would take advantage of that facility as to where to look for things on the internet or sign up or whatever. More quotes on support for such a resource. I'll just spin through these. If you wish to take a closer look at them, you're quite welcome to look at the version that's available at the Research Center. A couple of quotes on the impact. Again, you can read those yourself, but some of the called a trend, if you will, or a theme, is this idea of keeping people on the island, be they high school children, students, or tradespeople, or people finishing or aspiring to a post-secondary education, allowing them to stay on the island as long as they would like or as often as they would like is indeed an important concern. Same thing here. And I'll just, using up my time here, skip to the conclusions. So the suggestion is that as a result of this needs assessment, the integration of this room to learn facility into community school would be extremely helpful. There would be a lab, there'd be kitchen facilities and peer support, as I mentioned. Hiring a coordinator of some kind, somebody with hopefully experience in distance education, somebody with experience at perhaps possessing or hopefully possessing a bachelor's degree, if not more. Some equivalent funding from the local school board for that coordinator and computer resource funding would be much help. And then some of the usual liaising with BC Ministry of Education officials and Labor officials. Now, the possible outcomes, if something along these lines, were to be implemented, would be, as listed here, The first one, again, is the possibility of doing away with excessive travel time for these students. Remember, 4 hours a day. And very quickly, your suggestion would be, if possible, to coordinate with the Courtney Comox School Board, is to set I guess it would be a schedule, within a schedule for those high schools and middle schools, where these island students and other islands, of course, beyond Hornby Island, but might take their courses that require labs or those kinds of resources, to take them on a particular days of the week in concert, and then allow these students to remain at their homes on these respective islands and do their high school coursework, social studies, English, humanities, whatever, online with the coordinator at the Room to Grow. This is to keep them, or reduce the amount of time they spend traveling each week to the school. Reversing the trend of families leaving, hopefully that would occur. High level of education is fine. Quality of trades work, that would be crucial to how many people earn their money. They're living on the islands by working in the trades. And finally, there's always a move, or quite often a move, to do away with schools of one kind or another, community schools, perhaps for cost-cutting reasons. And this facility would likely work in the favor of island residents to keep their school open. That's it. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Hope you found something interesting in all this, and I'll turn it over to the next speaker.
Well, I guess that would be me. Hi, I'm Deborah Hoven. I hope you can all understand my accent. I'm an associate professor in the Centre for Distance Education, and I'm just going to have a quick run through today about two aspects of research projects that I've been working on in the last 18 months or so. I've titled the presentation Digital Storytelling and E-Portfolios for Language and Culture Revitalization, but I haven't actually got a lot in here about e-portfolios, because that was more of a collective project that we've been working on within the centre with several other faculty members and with the students in the centre. But obviously, digital storytelling has a lot of connections with the e-portfolio aspects of assessment, etc. What I want to talk about today is some aspects of digital storytelling in building communities in Indigenous communities and across communities and across cultures. So I'll just move on. First of all, the way this came about was, I started to develop a model in the last 2 to 3 years for technology-enhanced language learning. Now, this is an aspect, language learning and teaching, has been dear to my heart for many years. And the aspects of technology, how technology can enhance the learning of languages. And after a literature survey of recent, current, and cutting-edge applications of technology for language learning and teaching, I came up with these six models of recent and current practices. And if you look at the last one there, narrative and reflective call, obviously there are some some interplay between these different aspects, communication and social networked and collaborative, of course, and narrative and reflective call is computer assisted language learning. I prefer the term technology enhanced, because that can incorporate and include the uses of online technologies, as well as the communications aspects that don't just restrict us to the older forms of computer-based or computer-anchored learning. So my main focus in the last year or so now has been the sixth one, narrative and reflective computer or technology-enhanced language learning. And to to work on this, I applied for and got a mission critical research grant through the through Athabasca University to look at the possible roles of digital storytelling in Indigenous education. Now, many of you will be aware that with Indigenous communities in Canada as well as in Australia and Alaska and other parts of the world, there's similar problems to what Tom has just been talking about with communities, people leaving the community, not being able to maintain the schools within the community, etc. And in Indigenous communities, this is made even more complex by issues of conflict between cultural expectations and values, and also language loss of first language when the instruction is all in the second language, which is often which is usually English, and also loss of community cohesion when children have to go away for school, or when older youth have to go away for any higher education. And there's also that dislocation and cut in community and cut in connections. So all of these aspects were interesting for me from perspective coming from Australia to Canada and looking at some of the issues, reading the press, reading the literature, and seeing that there are a lot of similar problems across between Australia and Canada with Indigenous education. And also from a prior study I'd done in Alaska. So I was looking at whether and to what extent it would be possible to make some connections, find out what people are doing, and help different communities in different locations share their solutions and their approaches to these issues. So I interviewed as a result of this project 15 people in the Yukon, two locations in the Yukon, and in Australia, four locations, and I put that together with interview information and visits that I'd been able to make in Alaska. So what I was looking at in terms of narrative and reflective technology enhanced language learning is starting from the personal, so ownership and direction, looking at personally meaningful language, the use of language for real purposes and real audiences, and using a range of media and seeing what media are available, what media people are comfortable using. Looking at how the learning focused and learner focused can help make it more meaningful for people participating in education, and available either divergent or convergent, and digital storytelling and e-portfolios are the two manifestations of these. As I said, I'm not going to talk too much about e-portfolios because that has a lot of assessment, evaluation, etc., and other issues. But digital storytelling as a way of finding, helping learners find their own path through the education systems, and also helping them make connections between their own personal life and informal, non-formal learning, as well as the formal learning process. So digital storytelling basically can be a range of different things. Traditional stories recorded or illustrated in digital format, sharing of stories. These days can also be online logs, journals that can be static or interactive, can be biographical or autobiographical, can be collaborative or group or community projects, and can be also personal and or emotional reactions and narrations of critical, educational, personal, family experiences, events. So you can see through that, I think, that there are very many ways that different forms of digital storytelling can be used to help learners make the link between personal, society, community, culture, in first and second culture and first and second language. So it can be reflective, sharing, presentation, showcase, multimedia, etc. So the purposes, as I've sort of mentioned earlier, literacy, second language literacy, where the second language is often English. Often the second language is the language of their first culture, the language of their families, but they have never actually learnt it, never actually spoken it. And so this is where the revitalisation comes in, and the addition of multimedia literacy, uses of cell phones for photography and recording, also for MP3 players, and using digital cameras, both video and still, and helping with reconnecting with heritage and family cultures and traditions, intergenerational community and communication, where often in some cases grandchildren can't communicate with their grandparents because they don't share a language, and often don't share these days, don't share a cultural understanding, as a means of expression, and also as an avenue of creativity and or fun, to be fun and motivating, and also to make the mainstream curriculum more meaningful, to help learners find their own voice, their own way of understanding, expressing and negotiating the mainstream curriculum, to link their first language persona and confidence communication skills in the second language or third or other language, intergenerational collaboration, sharing, and then teaching and learning of technical skills, etc. So, as part of my project, then these are some of the examples that I found among the various communities and people that I interviewed and spoke to and visited, traditional as well as more contemporary examples. So obviously there's a lot of archive material out there for many decades. Anthropologists have been going to Indigenous communities and interviewing people, videoing people more recently, and these digital records can now be archived and represented and made accessible by the communities themselves, and the communities themselves are now starting to have control over how they want their communities and their cultures represented, who and how these can be accessed and accessed by, and some rediscovery also among the current generations of more of the experienced history of their elders. So the Nanana project in Alaska is a project that's been produced by the Indigenous people in the Nanana Valley, and it's recordings, archived stories by elders, and sometimes produced by the younger people, sometimes from the archives of anthropologists. The Ara Iritja project in Australia has become a massive undertaking where all digital images that all communities in the central and southern desert of Australia have started to put together. Any images, any artifacts, collecting and contributing artifacts that they have or they've heard about or that they know the location of, requesting them back from museums in various other parts of the world as well as parts of Australia, and making digital images and attaching stories to those images, to be accessible by the communities from which those artifacts originally came. And So they are the archival aspects of digital storytelling. There's also things like collaboratories, where different communities collectively put their ideas, understandings together. Different members of the community, individuals within it, work together to produce something that's new and original that couldn't be produced by any one of those communities alone. In Western Alaska, models of immersion school, for example, where elders come into the school, their visits are videoed and recorded, they tell stories, they teach students how to create certain artifacts that are necessary for dances and other culturally significant events, and these are all then videoed and recorded and used for subsequent training and education of students. Then there's the more youth-oriented and youth-originating aspects, student blogs and wikis. For example, two examples here, the Russian Mission School is a wonderful example of student-created logs and blogs when they went on fishing and berry picking camp during the summer and collected the images and put together their own log and their own perspectives on what they experienced, what they learnt, what value they derived from that. And the Marshall School is a collaborative wiki. It's multi-school and audio annotated. So this is a location, an online location, where different students from different schools across Alaska and North America, and also obviously the world, can contribute their own stories of their daily life, their school life, camping, different stories of their culture that helps them to communicate with other students in different parts of the world, with other students from Indigenous communities, and also to promote literacy in second language English, but also pride in their first language and culture. The last example here from Yukon is the Ku Klux and Kandik Maps Project, embodying traditional learning with elders, discovery and experiential learning, collaborative learning, community involvement, creation, actualization, performance, and then global presentation in the form of video, which they are then putting online. So this was a presentation in the Yukon by the creators of the video and the instigators of the project, where they work with students in different schools and different locations in the Yukon to establish and maintain understanding of historical events that are significant in the communities. And finally, a couple of Australian projects. The Walter Project, which is a community self-help resources site, and a wonderful site, the Napachi Napachi Project, created by young people who are dislocated and alienated from their culture and language and are starting to regain that culture and language through their own creations, their own stories, their own performances, their own songs. And the last website here is, you can access it yourself, the Napachi Project, and there's some examples there of how students and community members have created their own digital movies and still photos to tell their story, regaining their culture and language. So looking from the past to the present to the future is what I'd like to continue to investigate. Thank you. Who's next?
It's Pat Fay. I just had to cut you off there, Deborah. Sorry, got the mic from you. Happy to have a chance to talk about two or three projects that I'm working on, not only because I'm interested in them myself, but because I think they tell us something about where our university is going and what direction the institution might be taking, and it's, I think, somewhat surprising, as you may see as we go along. I'm going to talk about three projects. One, the first one, the Learning Communities Project in the oil sands and rural, remote, and Aboriginal communities of northern Alberta. Second is the Getting Online or Go Project for literacy workers, and the third one, an Alberta North project about the attraction, preparation, and retention of northern Alberta Aboriginal students, something that is just starting, and Diane and I are working on together as principal investigators. Learning Communities Project began actually in 2006 and was originally called something to do with rural and remote areas. It had drifted around for a while, but has come back to that objective or that focus right now. It has these objectives: to add a learning dimension to the workplaces in northern Alberta, especially the oil sands. So that second point, for corporate sponsors, and this was a sponsored project. We received quite a large grant from a senior official of one of the major oil sands players, to try to permit the employers to do a better job of attracting and then subsequently retaining their skilled workers. You have to picture the life in camp up there. Might surprise you to learn that the average age of the camp worker is in their 40s. These are not young guys. It's predominantly and massively male. These are not just youngsters. The average age in their 40s, there is, of course, a great range, but when you stand and watch the shift change, you'll see a lot of gray beards. A lot of people have been at this for a long time. Some of them are looking for career change. So there's that third point. Some of the employees' objectives are to prepare to change, to leave that work. One of the questions we got asked most often when we were on the site was, how do I move out of here? How do I find either another employer or another job or another place to practice this trade or technology? Learning communities in general, and this is, I think, near and dear to the heart of our university, how do we make learning feasible in rural and remote areas? Now, you've heard from Tom and Deborah just now about their work with non-traditional, non-standard, non-focal sorts of audiences. This is another example of this, rural and remote communities. And finally, for the province itself and for its institutions, how do we promote better and make those institutions better at dealing with the needs of non-standard learners? Now, I'd like to give you a little context. I've lived in this province for over 35 years. And it was only in the last couple of years that I became aware of that whole northern two-thirds. We talk about Edmonton being northern Alberta. The geographic center of the province is Athabasca. It's within a mile or two of the geographic center. So half of the province is north of you, where you're sitting right now. When you leave an area, say, east of Fort Smith or west of Uranium City, Saskatchewan, Northwest Territories, and proceed south, you very quickly come to our eponymously named Lake Athabasca. But notice the lay of the land here. Really rugged, really different, really remote, but very resource intensive. It isn't long coming down from the north before this begins to be seen along the river. That's the Athabasca River on the bottom. You've been hearing about tailings ponds and so forth. Well, there they are. They really do exist, and they're not, as you'll see in another picture in a moment or two, very, very well insulated from the river. The scale of the industrial expansion up there and the industrial exploitation of the oil sands is tremendous. These are all, it takes about an hour to travel at 125 miles an hour past all of the development between that area where it starts and the area just north of Fort McMurray where it more or less ends. So in those areas, certainly in the industrial areas, there's a need for, and we think a demand for, on-site learning, learning that can be worked around very heavy shifts, people who are commuting in and out on various different kinds of shift schedules from 5 off to 19 on, 10 off. The schedules are very varied. So the audiences for the Learning Community Project and the project principles are to meet the needs of the four targeted audience, the camp workers, oil camp, oil sands camps, and remote camps, northern and rural residents and aboriginals, starting with the Horizon site. One of those pictures was of the Horizon site, a Canadian natural resources development. Secondly, to develop partnerships with other communities and other providers based on their needs, interests, and preferences. So we're genuinely focused on what Athabasca University does, which is try to tailor programming to the needs of the audience. And finally, to show the participating and collaborating communities how they can contribute effectively in the forms of access to employees or access to or facilities, time, expertise, and material support. Now, one of the products of this project, and this is something I find interesting, and I think, again, it's one of the things that, that we do. There are 20 private colleges in Alberta, 4 universities, and 2 institutes of technology, public colleges rather. There are a number of private institutions, and most of those institutions say they offer distance education. What they often mean is they offer a blend of what we call quadrant one, same time, same place learning, and something else. Now, just to quickly go over these quadrants, this is what we're trying to explain to our collaborators and to the potential consumers of the programming that we're putting together. There's same time, same place learning, which is what we do in classrooms. Everybody comes together in the same geographic location at the same time and interacts. Then there's quadrant two, which is same place but different time. That's what we have when we require a student, for example, to come into the learning center to do a lab or watch a video or something. They can do it any time, but they have to come to a central place. This is we found this to be the model of one of the nursing programs. It was a nursing assistant program that was offered through eCampus Alberta. It looked like it was online. In fact, it was called online. But it had a chunk of time where you had to go to a hospital and do a practicum. That was quadrant two. So it was some of it was quadrant four, same time or different time, different place, your time, your place. But a lot of it was quadrant two. Quadrant three, different place, same time. That's what we're doing right now. I'm in Edmonton. Many of you are in Athabasca. Some are in various parts of Western Canada. We're all here at the same time, but we're in different places. So video conferencing, teleconferencing, audiographic teleconference, anything synchronous but dispersed is quadrant three. Quadrant four is what we're looking for, and that's what we're trying to convince our partners is what is needed up there, something that can be done at the time and the place of the learner without any compromise to that model. So if you can't deliver it completely quadrant four, you should admit it and say that you're quadrant two, quadrant three, comma four, whatever it is, even quadrant one. The institutions don't like to think that way. They think that if they have any quadrant four, they can call themselves distance. We disagree, and we in our publications we're trying to make the point why that's the case. I've covered this to some degree, why this is important. The northern part of the province, of course, this was all before the collapse, basically, of our North American and world economies, but there was and is a great reliance in the north and in rural and remote areas of our province and our country on mobile workers. Mobile workers are workers who do not plan and never will live in the community in which they work. There's good data about that. Only a small fraction of the workers in the Wood Buffalo region, for example, where Fort McMurray is located, have any thought or any intention ever to live there. They consider themselves mobile, and they are proud of that, and they want to hold on to that. But we can, meaning Athabasca University, may be able to address the learning needs of that group because we deliver mobile learning. The retirement levels are, you're familiar with, the average age in the construction industry is mid-40s, and that's a young man's game. People don't stay in the construction industries into their declining years. Even 45 is old. My brother, who's a commercial electrician, became an inspector when he turned 41 because his knees were shot. That's not unusual, so those are the people who may need some help looking for a transitional career. There's an exceptionally high level of need for very sophisticated project management in the oil sands. These are very complex, probably some of the most complex construction projects in all history. The Horizon site was $9.5 billion, and that's one of seven in the area. We can provide, through our School of Business and SIM, we can provide training on-site, in-situ, and at the pace and place of the learner more than anyone else. Finally, life and work balance. This is something that is easy to sell, but hard to buy. Everybody up there understands that the workers are working way too hard, including the office staff, the administration, the planners, the executives. Nobody up there believes they have a life. They're all looking forward to the day when they can get out of this rat race. We come in to say, if you wait long enough, that will never happen. And if you don't do it now, the benefits will not be there when you need them, namely the ability to think clearly and maintain a focus on a complex process. So what we're trying to offer in through this project and through our researchers up there is insight into how there can be some life and work balance. So we've had people come up and talk about nutrition, about how to use spare time, about music appreciation. A whole range of different topics have been and will be offered on site besides the standard academic fare, just to try to add some life work balance and get people thinking outside of their daily grind. There have been a number of published products. We have 9 occasional reports. Those are short statements of what we've been observing. There are 2 extensive interim reports. There's a published paper in the Journal of Vocational Education and Training that came out last year, and there's a paper in press right now. So if you want any of these or want to have a look at any of these, just let me know. Another project, this one's close to my heart because I come from an ESL and language background and worked on literacy for years. The GOAL project, Getting Online project, which is about to end. Very briefly, literacy workers in Canada, indeed in the world, are the poor sisters and brothers of every other academic. They get nothing in the way of support, they get nothing in the way of pay, and they get nothing in the way of prestige. The list goes on and on. One of the things they get nothing in the way of is professional development. It's an old story, but because they have so few resources, they can't expend anything on their own growth and development. This project was funded by, at the time, the National Literacy Secretariat to try to determine whether literacy workers would accept online professional development. The project is just about over. It was designed to develop and pilot test training, online training, and to develop a best practices manual. We have a paper in press right now that describes what was found when we did a survey of the values and preferences of the literacy workers. Quite surprisingly, they are quite interested in distance. They do not have a predisposition against technology. Some of the things that we've always thought and I think were true 20 years ago aren't true anymore. There is a research report online. There's the link. The third course is being piloted right now. We have improved the course each time by using formative results. And finally, the Promising Practices Manual will be available by June. So any of you with an interest in language might want to look at that. Finally, the Alberta North Project, this just started, will run till 2011. This is the one I'm working with Diane Conrad on. Is intended to help Alberta North, which has 80-some CAP, Community Access Point, sites in northern Alberta and the southern NWT, do a better job attracting, preparing to use distance materials and retaining of their students, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal. The project was the result of an innovation grant that was obtained by Alberta North. They went, they got the money, then they went looking for principal investigators. They found Diane and me, and we will be working with them to evaluate what they do over the next little while. What we're expecting to do, we've already done a workshop at NAIT. There is in process, Tim Slaughter and his group are working on a 5-year Alberta North research plan along with the Alberta North people. That is long overdue. They believe that research should be a part of their natural and regular mandate and workday. And so with the 5-year plan, they'll be able to do that better. We're going to produce a handbook of effective practices in attracting and preparing distance learners. We're also going to do some research about what the CAP sites are currently being used for, how they're being used, and how they might be used. We're going to pilot some innovative delivery through those CAP sites, and at the end of it all, we should be able to get back to partners like eCampus Alberta and the government agencies, the Ministry of Advanced Education and Technology, and tell them what is actually going on out there. So thanks for your attention, and I'll turn it over now to, I think it's Mohammed, is it?
I completed a few projects in the area of mobile learning in distance education and workplace learning. So I will present briefly three of those projects in my presentation this afternoon. But before we get into the projects, here is a brief definition of mobile learning. And that's one I came up with in 2005, and I think it still stands today. It's simply delivery of electronic materials on mobile devices. And there are a variety of mobile devices out there. And the last statistics I saw on the number of different types of mobile devices out there was 3,700. So the challenge is, how do we design instruction, learning materials for delivery in 3,700 different mobile devices? It's quite a challenge. And two other keywords there is access from anywhere and anytime. So we have a mobile workforce right now. We have people who are nomads. They tend to move from one location to the next. So if we design for mobile delivery, they'll be able to access their learning materials from anywhere and anytime. So the two keywords are anywhere and anytime. The first project was mobile learning in computer science. I work with Karen Stauffer from the School of Computing Information System. And what we did is we converted a course for delivery on both desktop notebook computers and mobile devices. So we want to check and see whether students will actually access their courses on their mobile devices. We need to find out if it was meeting the student requirements, because most of these students are actually working full-time in the workplace, and they tend to be mobile. So we want to find out what type of a devices they're using and if they're actually accessing the courses on the mobile devices. One of the things that we had to do is to design the course so that students can read it on a large screen, on a mobile device screen. So we had some sort of an agent that looks at the device, and if it's a certain size, it will format the information for that device. If it's a smaller size, then it will format it for the small screen. So if you take a look on the left-hand side, the information is formatted for a large screen. So if the screen size is greater than or equal to 800, it will deliver the full style sheet. And if it's less than, it will deliver for mobile device. So the left-hand side is the screen on a regular computer, and the right-hand side is on a mobile device. So the system will actually adjust the information for the type of delivery technology. And this slide shows the same thing, but on the left it shows delivery of a graphic on a large screen and delivery of the same graphic on a mobile device. And as you can see, the quality is not that much different. It's nice and clear on the mobile device. So we have Karen wrote a program to check the screen size, and then the system will actually adjust information for the different screen size. So it's an ongoing study. We had over 500 students look at the courses on mobile devices. And we asked them to complete a survey after they complete part of the course on the mobile device. These students, they had no problem accessing the learning materials on their mobile devices. And here is a list of devices that they reported that they use during their learning with the mobile devices. And as you can see, it's quite a variety of devices. So it's interesting to see that we can actually deliver learning materials on a variety of mobile devices. But I mentioned the challenge is how do you design for 3,700 devices? That will be the major challenge in the future. And they access the course materials using Wi-Fi, phone plans, and desktop synchronization. So different methods of access. We ask students if mobile devices are suitable for learning, to access learning materials. And as you can see, the majority says strongly agree or agree. And we ask them over the flexibility of mobile learning. And again, quite a few says strongly agree, and some says agree. So this group was pretty comfortable with mobile devices. They think it was a good experience. The second project is use of mobile devices in English as a second language. And we did a few research projects, myself, Rory McGreal, and the library staff. And that's where we develop English as a second language, English grammar lessons for delivery on mobile devices. And the subjects for this study were English as a second language foreign workers who just came to Canada and they were actually looking for jobs. So they had to improve their English. They were just about to get into the workforce. And very interesting, in this project, we tested the use of a variety of evaluation type instruments to assess learning. So students access the lessons using mobile phones with wireless capabilities. In terms of the question type, so students were able to access multiple choice questions, true, false, matching, and word ordering using their mobile devices. So as you can see, you can be creative and have different testing techniques on mobile devices. And this is one of the areas we need to do more research on, how do we do e-assessment for online learning and in mobile learning. So most students prefer the true-false and multiple-choice question, but 18% the matching and 47% word ordering. So we use a variety of evaluation instruments. And we also gave a pretest, post-test, and retention tests. And you can see there was an improvement from the pretest to the post-test, but not much difference between the post-test and the retention test. The other project is Moodle on mobile device, and this is one that Margaret Kuhl and I worked on. And we look at students' attitude, perceived usefulness of the mobile device. We look at the impact, study patterns, social effects, and pedagogical effects. We also look at the usability. And this study is based on Margaret Kuhl's thesis, where she created a model for mobile learning. And as you can see there, it's in the center it says mobile learning, DLS, where she looked at the social aspect, the device aspect, and the learner aspect. So an entire thesis was developed using this model, and she called it the FRAME model. So the subjects for the study was our mass of education students, and we use the Moodle learning management system. And the software was actually developed at the University of Glamorgan by a doctoral student. And it also uses cellular or Wi-Fi devices. So phase one, which was a pilot, we had four subjects between 26, 56 years. And we piloted the software, the training materials, and the questionnaire. And then in phase two, we had 16 subjects between 26 and 56 years. And 12 had high computing skills, 3 advanced, and 1 low computing skills. And they were weekly activities, and they had pre and post questionnaires. In terms of the results we obtained, in terms of interaction learning, the current frequency of interaction is fairly low, yet learner respond feel very connected. So learner thought that they already had enough interaction. They were already connected, so they did not need to use the mobile devices. So it did not increase their sense of connectedness. So they felt that using the desktop notebook computer was enough connection to the instructor and other students. In terms of the social technology, they rate need for flexible access to the learning management system. They think that there should be more flexibility in terms of access. Need for flexible mobile access low, and recognize that mobile access is advantageous for travelers. And one learner felt that mobile access was only useful for checking an activity and will not encourage learning. So check and see what's going on in the course and what others are doing, etc. Some felt mobile access was intrusive, but some of the subjects, in terms of their expertise of technology, they had a low understanding of mobile devices. And actually, this was the first time that some of them were actually using mobile devices. They prefer email as the preferred mode of communication. And again, that has to do with the demographics. Most of these subjects were older. In terms of the future of mobile learning research, we're currently preparing a proposal to look at how we can use mobile devices in pronunciation, accent reduction. We have a lot of foreign workers who have a big accent when they come to Canada. How can we have training materials on the mobile devices to help them reduce their accent? We are looking at a proposal for use of mobile devices in learning French and different languages. Use of mobile devices in libraries. Lots of potential for students to access the library materials from anywhere, anytime. And we have a collaboration with the Open University of the UK where we are looking at mobile libraries, use of mobile technology in library. We need to look at mobile social software, Web 2.0 on mobile devices, and how do we run Moodle on mobile devices. And we're also currently looking at use of multimedia on mobile devices for delivery anywhere, anytime. And in terms, I just edited a book on the use of mobile libraries to provide virtual access with someone from the Open University of UK. It was published by Facet Publishing, and I just edited a book on mobile learning, and it's in press, and it should be out anytime now. Thank you.
It's Marty again. Thank you to the audience in Athabasca that has hung in there for those lengthy presentations, and to those of you in Illuminate as well. We're now ready for comments and questions. If you're shy and you're working in Illuminate, you can certainly text in your question, and our facilitator will read it to me, and we'll get you to the right person to create an answer. Well, I'm going to try as in my role as a facilitator, one strategy to see if we can generate some questions and see what that does. I guess I would like to hear from at least one person in the audience something that you're working on. And there we go. We have a hand raised. Leslie, we see your hand raised. The moderator is going to give you the microphone. At the bottom left-hand corner of the screen.
Okay, I think we got it now. Can you hear me? I was really interested in Deborah's discussion of digital storytelling in Alaska. I wish I'd gotten to see some more examples. I'd like to learn more about how that works for language learning, if she has any comments there. Thanks.
Thanks, Leslie. Yes, I was hoping that was you there with Leslie J. Hi. I'd like to hear from you too. If you could email me, we could set up a time to talk about it in more detail. But basically, in Alaska, there are several immersion schools for mainly for Yupik and in the West Alaska Bethel area, and they're working really hard with the University of Alaska, mainly through Fairbanks and the Rural and Community Development Department, to train teachers locally who are young adult speakers of the local language while they are still in the community, so by distance. But the little project there, the Ayaprun School is a fully bilingual elementary school, and they have a range of really interesting programs. Some teachers are less good at it than others, but I'm happy to talk about it in detail in another forum over.
Thank you for that question. And now I'm going to turn the mic to Steve Schaefer.
Steve Schaefer, Library Services. I just have to say, it's been a great journey being involved in some of these applications. We've done a little bit with the learning communities. We've done a little bit with ESL. We're familiar with Alberta North for quite some time. That indeed has quite some history. And we've been having a lot of fun seeing how some of these things can work together and increase the opportunities for indeed any time, any place. I think the thing that's been on my mind in this quest for comments is seeing something done on iTunes U. I've spent some time on that. And I think there's an option there and some wonderful opportunities for the AU community to put some things up there. I know in Library Services we've had a little bit of discussion on YouTube or iTunes U. And I always see, iTunes U appearing to be a bit more academic and scholarly than YouTube. But I'd sure like to see some exploration in that. And I think the other thing I'd like to say is that as we're able to, we'd like to continue to participate in and support and learn with and see how distance education, online learning, and mobile learning can continue to advance creating more opportunities for both teaching and for learning.
Thank you very much, Steve. You'll notice throughout the presentations the mix of curiosity-driven research with very practical applied approaches to pushing the envelope in education. You will find that those things that make us curious will also in the end, of course, change what it is that we're doing. But we also are very committed to pushing the envelope to solving the very real and serious issues that we face in education to make sure that that education anywhere, anytime is available to all those who are interested in participating. So I would send a question again out to the audience to say, one, is there anything that piques your curiosity that you think would be an interesting and valuable piece of research? And secondly, what problems do you see that need to be solved based on the Athabasca mission? Seeing none, I will take the mic and say give you one last bit of information before we say goodbye today. We have in the Center for Distance Education created a website called CDE Reads. Reads stands for Research, Exploration, and Discussion Site. At the moment, we are experimenting with this site, and it is open to our students and faculty. However, I would love to hear from anyone who's interested in participating on this site and joining us in the discussion of research for distance and distributed learning and drawing ideas and learning about the other activities that are going on campus. So you can email me. It's very simple, MARTIC, M-A-R-T-I-C, at, and you know the rest, if you're interested in access to that site, and we'll make it happen for you. Thank you very much for your participation today. We would love to hear from you, and we'd love to join in any projects that you're interested in, or that if you find anything we're doing interesting, we certainly want to hear from you. Bye.